This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, September 19th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Last Saturday, aerial strikes damaged more than a dozen oil installations in Saudi Arabia, hitting one of the most critical production facilities in the world. Aramco, the country's national oil company, temporarily suspended production, forcing up global oil prices. Although Houthi rebels in Yemen have claimed credit for the attack, it is widely believed that Iran, which has been supplying arms to the group, is behind it. On Sunday evening, President Trump tweeted that the United States was locked and loaded and indicated that he was looking to the Saudis to set the terms for retaliation. But then he maintained that he doesn't want war with anybody. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif had steadfastly denied that Iran had anything to do with the attacks, and he warned today on CNN that any retaliatory strikes by the U.S. or Saudi Arabia would result in war, saying that we won't blink to defend our territory. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo had this to say from Abu Dhabi.
We are still striving to build out a coalition. I was here in an act of diplomacy while the foreign minister of Iran is threatening all-out war and to fight to the last American. We're here to build out a coalition aimed at achieving peace and a peaceful resolution of this. That's my mission set. It's what President Trump certainly wants me to work to achieve. And I hope that the Islamic Republic of Iran sees it the same way. There's no evidence of that from his statement, but I hope that that's the case.
Robin Wright, a New Yorker contributing writer, joins me to discuss how Iranian leaders view U.S. policies in the Gulf and how the Trump administration has unwittingly strengthened the regime's hardliners. Robin, welcome back.
Always great to be with you, Dorothy.
We seem to be facing the foreign policy crisis that Trump critics have been really dreading ever since he took office. Worries in the U.S. early this summer about a potential war in the Gulf after the U.S. and Iran each shot down one of the other's drones, those worries had receded. This attack in Saudi Arabia, whether by the Houthis or by Iran, seems to have somewhat taken the administration by surprise. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about what we know about how Iran sees the strategic situation.
Ironically, Iran feels rather lonely in the region. It looks at its neighbors, whether it's the Gulf sheikdoms or the South Asian countries of Afghanistan and Pakistan to the east and to the north, the former Soviet republics, now the stands, as we call them. And these are all Sunni countries. And Iran is the world's largest Shiite country. It feels both in terms of sectarian differences and ethnically isolated.
But it's also, I just have to interrupt you there, it also is the most militarily powerful in the region, is it not?
It depends on how you count militaries. It certainly has, in terms of manpower, it has a much larger military than any other country in the region. But when it comes to equipment, Saudi Arabia is far better armed. Saudi Arabia last year spent $67 billion on equipment, five times more than Iran did.
Much of it American equipment.
Much of it American or Western. And so these are two countries engaged in a kind of asymmetric conflict with very different kinds of capabilities. But as we saw over the weekend, Saudi Arabia, despite all its investment in defense, was not able to defend itself.
You know, the Iranians aren't wrong to see how enamored Trump has become with the Saudis. He was very warmly received on his first foreign trip, which happened to be to Saudi Arabia. His son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has made no secret of his friendship and strategic alliance with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. And there were no real serious consequences for the Saudis, even after the CIA concluded that MBS had ordered the assassination and dismemberment of Jamal Khashoggi, a Saudi dissident and a contributing columnist to The Washington Post. So, seeing it from the perspective of the Iranians, I wonder about their bellicosity. And how much of it is driven by fear, and how serious are they in their current attack mode?
Well, one of the big questions is intent. Was this to signal to the outside world, most notably the United States, that it was not going to tolerate being isolated, being sanctioned, and that anyone who tried to corner or marginalize or isolate Iran would pay a price? And how do you do that? Well, you go after Saudi Arabia's oil installations, which account for 5% of the global oil consumption. But Iran has also been helping its proxies in the region. And one of the most important trends we see is the shifting strategic balance of power. And it's not just the recent attack on Saudi oil installations. Iran, across the region, has built a network of allies now so that if it is ever attacked, it can unleash its allies, its surrogates, its proxies in at least a half a dozen countries that could then target the United States, its allies, its embassies, its military bases, and that there would be a price to pay that Iran does not have to worry just about defending its territory. It can fight any conflict outside its territory, too. And that's one of the things that I don't think that we've paid enough attention to in looking at what are the challenges in the Middle East. How are wars fought? We're so used to the conventional wars, tanks on the ground, you know, and now we're seeing a different kind of asymmetric conflict played out at a much wider array of territory.
And so Iran, in fact, isn't all that lonely since it has been very strategically savvy in lining up all of these allies.
That's true. But one of the things that's most notable is Iran has no real allies in governments across the region. It has some friends who are in positions of power in Iraq, for example, some in Lebanon. But its main allies, the proxies, are all non-state actors. They are all militias. They are all armed groups.
So that brings us to the civil war in Yemen. Isn't it true that just about a year ago, Pompeo and Jim Mattis, who was then Secretary of Defense, were calling for an end to the fighting there? That was, you know, a proposed act of diplomacy. It seemed like the right thing to do. Yemen has become a haven for militias and terrorists, and it is one of the biggest humanitarian crises in the world. But this administration isn't big on diplomatic follow-through. So what happened?
One of the problems is that Saudi Arabia does not yet feel it wants to end this grisly war that's raged on now for more than 4 years, killed tens of thousands of people, produced a cholera epidemic affecting more than a million. It is today the gravest humanitarian crisis. The United States and others have been calling for a cessation of hostilities because the war is in effect at a stalemate and the Saudis can't win it. Yemen has often been called Saudi Arabia's Vietnam. Yemen was in some ways a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. The Saudis didn't want a group in power in a country along its southern border that was allied with Tehran. But it now looks like the tensions between Iran and Saudi Arabia may be far more direct than at any time ever.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So it does seem pretty clear, correct me if I'm wrong, that Trump's strategy toward Iran, if it can be called that because it's so wildly inconsistent, it just isn't working. And it seems to go back to his pulling out of the nuclear deal and then imposing these tough sanctions that you referred to. And they seem to only have strengthened the Iranian hardliners.
Well, you're absolutely right that President Trump's decision to withdraw from the historic nuclear deal seems to have been the trajectory that led to the current crisis. There was a feeling that the nuclear deal could have opened the way for other negotiations. It would certainly prevent tensions and took the nuclear issue off the table so that discussions could play out over others. And the president not only walked away from the deal, but he imposed sanctions on Iran, tougher than ever. And Iran's oil exports have plummeted from 3.2 million barrels a day to somewhere around 300,000 barrels a day. So the economy is being severely impacted. And Iran feels that it doesn't have many mechanisms to get out of this. Now, the president has said he's willing to talk to President Rouhani. The French, under President Macron, have been negotiating quietly for months to try to pull a meeting off, the first time between an Iranian and American president since the 1979 revolution. That would be historic, too, to see if there's a way that they can freeze the current standoff. So we see rhetoric one moment from the president saying we're locked and loaded, and the next day he says he's still willing to meet with the president of Iran. There's a little bipolar diplomacy going on here.
And let's pause for a second just to talk about how the Iranians are responding to some of these European attempts to keep alive the 2015 deal, nuclear deal, and to find some kind of diplomatic resolution to these tensions. So Macron has offered Iran a $15 billion line of credit to ease the impact of the U.S. sanctions. And German Chancellor Angela Merkel has really urged all parties to return to the table.
One of the most important things, Dorothy, is that the five other signatories to that nuclear deal, the three major European powers, France, Britain, and Germany, as well as Russia and China, have all stuck to the terms of the nuclear deal, and they want to see the United States come back. They want to take steps that will avoid the exact kind of crisis we are facing today.
Last week, Trump fired National Security Advisor John Bolton, and Pompeo is currently the voice of hawkishness in the Trump's cabinet, although as we heard, he's also playing it both ways. It's too soon to tell exactly what effect Bolton's replacement, Robert O'Brien, is going to have on administration policy. But what was the purpose of Pompeo's trip to Saudi Arabia and the UAE this week?
Secretary Pompeo went to the Gulf to see senior Saudi and Emirati leaders to really try to broker a common strategy to mobilize a force to secure shipping in the Persian Gulf. The crisis with Iran really began with the sabotage of six tankers earlier this summer, and the U.S. had earlier tried to mobilize a Navy force, international naval force, to protect shipping in the Gulf so that you wouldn't see the attack on tankers again affecting the global oil supplies. And there was very little enthusiasm for it. A lot of countries don't want to sign up to a U.S.-led coalition. Look what happened in Iraq, you know, now in Afghanistan, but withdrawing and the Taliban actually is going to be a player in the future. U.S.-led coalitions have been troubled over the last two decades. Now the attack on the tankers, I think, has shifted some of the thinking, and the secretary is trying to exploit that. But some bigger decisions have to be made, and there are a number of options the United States faces. It's already said that it's going to impose much tougher sanctions on Iran. The U.S. can engage in cyber assaults, the kind of thing it reportedly did after the Iranians shot down a U.S. drone. There's a kinetic action, some kind of U.S. assault on whether it's the missile sites or drone sites of the wherever these 25 missiles and drones took off from. Or there's U.S. backing for a Saudi strike. After all, the attack was on Saudi Arabia, not on U.S. soil. And I think the president is very aware of the fact that Congress doesn't want another war, that the issue of trying to get an authorization for U.S. military action might come up. And the president, on the eve of an election campaign, doesn't want to get into something that may not just be tit for tat, but the Iranians, as they've pledged, would take much further.
And do you think Zarif is bluffing when he talks about going to war?
The Iranians are playing it both ways. the Iranians have come out repeatedly in recent weeks and said, we're not going to talk to the United States unless. There are a lot of caveats. And Iran is trying to signal that it is willing to talk to the United States, but it's not going to do the kind of engagement that was produced when the president saw Kim Jong-un of North Korea. It doesn't want a photo op. It wants specifics to come out of this. And the specifics include waivers on sanctions. And one of the most interesting things to happen over the past 2 weeks is that one of the last fights that John Bolton, as National Security Advisor, had with Donald Trump was over whether to give Iran waivers on sanctions that would then lead to a diplomatic opening. Bolton was deeply opposed, and Secretary of the Treasury Mnuchin had supported Trump's instincts to explore that option and providing a way forward. And the Iranians are signaling with their rhetoric, look, you strike us and we'll hit back. But they haven't closed the door completely on diplomacy. They just have put a lot of caveats. And that may make any future diplomacy, not just at the United Nations, more difficult. But I think there is still a scramble by the Europeans to see if they can pull something off. Everyone around the world, I think, wants to avoid yet another U.S.-led messy confrontation in the Middle East.
And then there's Israel, which is facing its own internal political chaos in the wake of the election. What are the ramifications of this crisis on that country?
Well, Iran has built up its allies across the region, and most of all in Lebanon and Syria along the Israel border. Iran has provided Hezbollah, its first ally, dating back to the 1980s, with more than 130 rockets or missiles, many of them with the ability to hit deep inside Israel. Syria is very interesting. Iran has exploited the chaos of the 8-year war in Syria and deployed missiles, and particularly missile kits that can convert imprecise rockets with a short range into longer range missiles with guided missile systems that can hit major strategic targets in Israel. Iran has cultivated an array of armed groups who are fighting not just to prop up the government of President Bashar Assad, but also to challenge Israel in some form, to lay the groundwork for somewhere down the road fighting along that Syrian-Lebanon border too. So the repercussions for Israel, which is in many ways the most important U.S. ally in the region, are very severe.
So the U.N. General Assembly is meeting next week, and I wonder what the latest news is about whether Rouhani will be coming to New York and how you expect that this issue to play out there.
President Rouhani and his foreign minister and a wider entourage do plan on coming to New York. This, in some ways, is a last-ditch effort. President Rouhani is today a lame duck. He had run in 2013 for the first of the two terms allowed for Iranian presidents on a nuclear deal, on ending Iran's pariah status. And he managed to achieve that in 2015. And of course, it's all gone down the tubes in the last year. And so his legacy depends a lot on whether he managed to salvage anything from that agreement, or at least a way forward to prevent the kind of tensions we're seeing become even bigger in the region and threatening Iran even more.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Robin Wright is a contributing writer at The New Yorker and the author of several books about the Middle East, including The Last Great Revolution, Turmoil and Transformation in Iran. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.